All right.
All right. Oh, and you've got the laptop. That's kind of... You can't speak? You're... It's Thursday, the 9th of December, 2004. This is Glenn Zuckman in Valencia, California. Actually, we're in the hills above, aren't we?
Green Valley.
We're in Green Valley. This is Glenn Zuckman in Green Valley, California, in the hills above Valencia, at the home of Lucky Ma... This is Glenn Zuckman in Green Valley, California, at the home of Stephen Mosco. I'm joined by my co-host, Amy Knowles. We're here with composers James Tenney and Stephen Lucky Mosco. Jim and Lucky, welcome to Border Patrol.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You both have had rather extensive, amazing, rich careers. You've lived and worked through Fluxus and John Cage. You've lived and worked through the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA and the destruction of the World Trade Center. I'm wondering, here in this vantage point of 2004, how you feel about the career you've chosen and the world we live in.
Well, I would not have made a different choice. I'm glad of the choice that I made. It's not easy being a composer, and sometimes it's frustrating because it's a role that doesn't have much power over political or social conditions. But it has a lot of power, I think, in terms of cultural consciousness. And I think in the future, history will view what we're doing as maybe even more important than what's going on in the social and political sphere, all right? But that's just my bias.
Certainly less destructive.
Yes.
Well, I was incurable. I started when I was 3, and I never had a choice. Music was always the way I thought. I can't think any other way than in music, basically.
And what does that mean, to think in music?
Well, you think in words, and they sort of go in loops. And music goes in spirals to me. It opens up things. It makes me go to other places where I can't get within words. And what my dear friend Mr. Tenney said, my sort of extension of that is, I think there's this huge chain which makes consciousness. And people believe in things. And if we sincerely do not believe in that, we're going to break the chain, and maybe we can make things better. But we can't do that by talking too much. We can do that by music, because we can break the chain there and reform the universe.
Well, you know, I mean, it seems to me, as we've obviously noticed in recent times, politics is a very divisive way of communicating, and it seems like the arts are a way that you can communicate and not be so divisive and express ideas and maybe even create change, and I don't know, somehow ways that are easier to connect to people without necessarily causing confrontation. Maybe there's confrontation sometimes.
Well, one thing to me that I've loved about music is that you can listen to a piece and no one can tell you how to listen to it. Afterwards, they can say you didn't hear it right or something like that. And you listen to a political speech and you're supposed to get it. And a piece of music, it's yours to absorb. That's why I love it.
Mm-hmm.
We were having this conversation the other day about program notes and whether or not they should be included in a program when someone comes to hear a piece of music. Maybe it's better to just experience it like you would a piece of art in a gallery if you're going to see a painting. Any thoughts on that?
I think program notes are useful, even though I hate to write them.
Yeah, that's where the conversation came from.
It always seems like a kind of unfortunate after the fact requirement, but I really do think they are useful to listeners, because you know it gives them something to hang on to, something to latch on to and relate to what they're experiencing directly in the music. I don't think they're really saying very much about the music. The musical experience is so far beyond what any program note can say, but it gives them, it gives people a way of sort of hanging on while they go through that musical experience. But the music is a, as Lucky says, I mean, it's a unique, a nonverbal kind of experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, actually, I don't mean to dominate the conversation here, but it brings me to a question I wanted to ask both of you about uniqueness. In this rather unique world of music that you're both in, which is a bit fantastic and somewhat foreign to still a large, you know, portion of the population, the two of you are even, you're at the furthest edge of it. And I'm wondering if you feel that way. I mean, when I hear your music, I get a sense of either that I'm listening to, I'm getting, in the case of Lucky's music, I feel as though I'm hearing little gems of some music from a completely later time in history, and maybe even another universe, and the same with yours, and Jim. And I don't. It's very interesting to have that sense with acoustic music, you know, that the music could be from another planet and not be the quote unquote electronic thing. But listening to this music with Jim's tuning systems, mm-hmm. which are so different from our, you know, 12 notes in a scale, and the phrases that Lucky puts together, it's so different and so unique. I'm wondering if that has made you feel on the outskirts, or has it been more of a struggle for you?
Well, you know, it's always a problem when people ask, you meet them on the plane or whatever, and they ask what you do, and you say, I'm a composer. And they say, well, what kind of music do you write? And I always used to have difficulty knowing how to answer that, but I finally figured out how to answer it. I say, I write unpopular music. And it always seems to me that they understand immediately what that means.
Oh, that's actually a functional description.
It really gets the idea across. So, no, it is, sure, it's a problem in some ways, but I don't think it's problematic. I don't really want to be mainstream.
No.
I don't want to be popular. I don't want to be any of those things. I want to be just what I am, which is as sort of isolated and eccentric and whatever, as, you know, a philosopher or a mathematician. These people don't expect to have huge audiences, and I don't either.
So, and your work has been related to science.
Well, that's another issue. I didn't say philosophy or mathematics because of my own connection to those things, but just because those are very esoteric disciplines.
True.
Where the idea of the numbers of your audience, it's irrelevant, right? Nobody asks that question. Well, I'm not concerned about that question either. Obviously, I do want some people to hear my music and appreciate it. But I think a sort of consideration that I've held for a long time is this. I'm not that different from other people. If I like what I've done, if I think what I've done is interesting, there's going to be a few other people in the world that will agree. And that's enough for me.
So what are these tuning systems that Amy referred to?
Let me just butt in once more real quick. I'm sorry. I know we can edit, thank God. And I'm not trying to bring this down. Right. My point actually was not losing or having a small audience, but the fact that there are genres of even new music, minimalism,
indeterminacy,
you know, the serialist,
yep.
You know, that whole thing. And neither one of you really belong to any of those camps.
No.
You know, you're both really alone in that world, which makes it so much more interesting to me to listen to. And I was just curious on that note, mm-hmm. You know, that it's not part of a style.
Right.
Or anything.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't identify it. You can't label it.
Yeah, right? We can't even pigeonhole you guys in something that's almost
that's
impossible.
That's good. I'm always
to pigeonhole. To
avoid,
you know,
that pigeonhole.
It's funny because you know your type. What'd you say? Unpopular music.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I always say American Depressionism. That's my style, American Depressionism. I think that's sort of like the same thing you're saying.
Is that meant to be historical or psychological?
Both. And my answer to that question is very simple for me, is that I've had a luxurious life of being able to write music without, you know, with teaching as my living. And if I want to get up in the morning and I'm so excited to write something, then I get up. And if I'm not, I don't want to write it. And I spent 3 years not writing music because I couldn't get up excited to write music. And I'm really excited when I write music now. I really enjoy it a great deal. But it's that's my only judgment, because what Jim said about audience, I absolutely, it's such a joy when someone likes your music, but you can't even begin to think about that when you're writing it, when you get up in the morning, because your excitement is getting up and, God, what would this be like to do this thing, you know, and see what it sounds like and all that. And I don't know if anyone will like it or not, but that doesn't really matter. But you do appreciate when they do. But that's not where it comes from, I don't think, in either of us in that sense. Right. It's not that we're discarding the audience saying, ah, you know, you bad people, you don't understand our music. It's not that at all. It's, I think we're both extremely compassionate and impulsive about an idea of a sound. And we can't wait to get up and maybe not even have a cup of coffee and get that sound down on paper. You know, and paper, and I have to say in a certain way too, that the dactyl sense of putting a note on a piece of paper is such a fulfilling thing in the morning. It's as good as orange juice.
And what is that idea of a sound? Is it something, do you hear it or see it, or is it a geometric sort of experience?
Well, it can be all of those. It can manifest itself in many different ways. It may be something that you imagine, that you hear in your kind of inner ear. It might be an idea about a process or a form. It can be a lot of things.
But Jim, don't you think, everything you're saying I know, and I know you real well with process and form and all that stuff, no matter what you say about that, you still hear it. It comes from sound.
Oh, yeah.
It starts from sound and then goes into idea, rather than starting from idea and going into sound.
For me, it can work both ways. It can work both ways, because sometimes...
But are they inseparable?
I don't think they're in conflict.
I don't either.
It can work both ways. In a way, it's like working from top down or bottom up.
Right.
It's there's one way of working, which is from the details up to the larger structure, the larger form. Another is conceiving of that larger form and then working down to the details. And I think they're just two different ways of working, in both viable ways.
May I ask a question now, if you don't mind?
Absolutely.
I think these days, because we're both teachers, and mm-hmm. somehow or another we both have been involved with teaching as part of our whole idea of music, that that's the responsibility. I feel now, right now, 2004, most of the composers that we teach are working from the bottom up and not the top down. Do you agree?
I agree.
And why? Why are they doing it?
Well, they did. The ones I'm teaching are in the past. I don't teach current composers. I stop, in fact, dealing with any composer as young as I am.
Okay. <Yeah.
laughs> Right. Because I think my judgment is going to be compromised. When I'm talking about older composers, I feel like I trust my own judgments better. But the bottom up procedure was the traditional compositional process. But I call it, I won't say that. I was about to say I call it the Hollywood composer image, but never mind. You'll edit this out, okay? Unless I come to it again later with a better framing. Okay. It was the traditional way of working. But what we have to remind ourselves is that the older composers, earlier composers, had what we now, when we try to work from top down, we're starting with the idea of a form and then working down to the details. Beethoven had that idea given to him by the culture. He didn't have to invent the sonata form. He inherited it. And he didn't have to worry about the top. He knew, right? So he worked from that kind of internalized idea of that form down to the details. But we don't have that anymore. And we have to deal with that top level.
And if I could be bold again and ask a question, why do you think that changed, that we're on the bottom now going up?
I'm not on the bottom going up.
No, I know you're not. No, I don't mean that at all. No, because I've known you for a long time.
Yeah.
Why, I'm talking about our students. Why do you think culturally now?
Because they have never been shown that there's another way. And now I will raise the image, or invoke the image, the Hollywood image of the composer, which is, in my mind, from the George Gershwin story. And I have this memory, it may not be accurate, but a memory of an image of George Gershwin at the piano in a smoking jacket with a glass of wine on the there and a cigarette in his cigarette holder, right?
Right.
And he's trying to find the next note, right? The right next note. It's going, okay, beginning of the, and then what's the next right note? And this is absolutely working from the bottom up, uh-huh. right? Saying, we're going to go from the beginning to the end of this piece, note by note. And that's
Can
just,
I interrupt just a
just,
second?
I just wanted okay. one more thing and then.
No, I want to go back.
Can you imagine a painter working like that?
Well, you know how George...
Working from the lower left-hand corner, gradually, up
but
through
you,
the whole
you
painting.
You know how he learned the piano?
Yes.
He had a player piano. He couldn't read music. He watched the keys move down. And he learned to play the piano watching the keys move down.
But
that's the bottom up.
This, by the way, is not intended as any criticism of George Gershwin, who love dearly. He was my first really important musical influence. The first influence on my composition was Gershwin.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
Because I loved it. Why else?
How old were you?
14? 15? It was before Satie and before Schoenberg and et cetera.
Keep going.
I feel very rude. I'm sorry. It's just that Jim and I have talked for a long time. We did a lot of interviews together.
Quite honestly, I mean, I don't want to usurp any of Amy's questions, but quite honestly, you guys are doing better. Yeah. I won't say without Amy, but certainly without me, you're doing better.
We're here for the whole evening. We have a lot of chicken and rice.
Have a dialogue.
Did anybody have the foresight to bring a bottle of wine out here?
We have a nurse.
And could you get me another bottle? Well, the beer's not important. No, I have plenty of beer.
Dorothy, mine's above the sink.
I saw it.
Yeah, I thought.